the power to raise the dead. Who can save us from our sin? He is our hope, our righteousness. Jesus, only Jesus.
Good morning. There we are. Good to see everyone out this morning. Welcome all those online that are worshiping with us this morning, or a Bible class this morning. We will be looking at Genesis 47. So as we prepare to open our class, would you please bow with me as we go to God in prayer? Our gracious Heavenly Father, we come to you this morning praising your name. We thank you so much for the blessings you've poured out on us throughout our lives, throughout the history of mankind. We thank you for your love and for your watch and care over us throughout all times. We thank you for Jesus who came and suffered and died for us to be the sacrifice to give us that hope to be with you forever. We thank you for the power he had to overcome death, to be raised for us, and to lead us home one of these days at the end of our lives or when he returns to this earth. Be with us this morning as we open your word and look at the old stories from Genesis that anchors our faith in you to see how much you've cared for mankind from the beginning. We ask you to be with those from our congregation here this morning that are suffering, those throughout this world who are going through different problems and torments and issues in their lives, from wars to floods to famine and all over. We ask you to be with them and help us to reach out and serve them and show them your love in our lives. We ask this now in Jesus' name. Amen. So as we continue on our study and journey through Genesis, can't remember when we actually first started this study. It's at least 47 weeks ago because we're on chapter 47, but some of those were doubled up, so maybe not quite that long. But January 1st, so almost all year then. So we are closing up here in chapter 47. There's 50 chapters in Genesis, and it seems like we've been studying Jacob for quite a while, hasn't it? We started in chapter 25. Half of Genesis focuses on Jacob's life. And it seems like half of Jacob's life is focused on Joseph. And I've always been taught that when God saw fit to put and repeat multiple times a story or a point or a name, it was important for us. And Jacob becomes Israel. And last Sunday, we looked at Israel leaving Canaan and moving to Egypt with his families. The next book, Exodus, we see the family Israel leave Egypt and go back to Canaan. So this one man, throughout all this time of our studies, you know, it seems like it gets redundant, and when you're reading it, if you're not really into the story or looking at why God's putting this in here, it just seems like it drags and it drags and it drags. You know, the end of Sunday, make sure it's turned on here. In chapter 46, it started out that Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to God, his father Isaac. So here, they're on their way back in chapter 46. And God promised him that night in a vision, says, I am your God, your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for there I will make you a great nation. And at the end of 46, we find out there's 70 people approximately going down to Egypt, heading that way with Jacob. We kind of see that with God telling Abraham, leave your homeland and go to a promised land that you don't know about. Here he told Jacob the same thing, called him Israel. as we open up, or at the end of this also, that when Jacob meets his father, they have their reunion. And what did he tell him before he goes to see Pharaoh? I'm going to go get Pharaoh, and you're going to talk to him. And if he asks you what's your occupation, what are you going to tell him? They're shepherds. We take care of livestock. And that is an abomination. And he warns his family, your job is an abomination here in Egypt. Welcome to Egypt. You're going to be an outcast. Basically. So as we open up our story in chapter 47, remember, they're traveling approximately 200 miles. It's kind of rounded to that. How long does it take to travel 200 miles? Anymore, that's nothing. You know, we jump and go 200 miles and back in a day. So I want you to go out and get all your donkeys and all your sheep and all your family and start walking 200 miles. How long is that going to take you? You think a car trip for 200 miles with kids is bad? Try taking a hike for 200 miles with kids and family and livestock and everything else. And the guys that had multiple wives, think about that. Going for 200 miles on a walking trip with your wife, now add two or three of them. You know, are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we sure we really want to do this? Whose idea was this anyway? You know, the first night it rains, you know, and everybody gets wet and the kids are scattered and who's taking care of what and who's going to cook again? Where are we going to find food? You know, they're carrying all the grain with them back. And so it's not a pleasure trip in that sense, but it's probably, if they can make 10 miles a day, it's going to take, you know, weeks, a month probably, to go from their homeland to someplace they've never been before for the families. Now, the brothers have been there twice ahead of this. This is their third trip, right? So when we see these stories that they went and they came back and they went and they came back, remember, there's probably a month between those time periods. We get reading verse to verse to verse to verse, it's real quick. But just think of those times, because remember, it was 2 years into the famine when they finally get back, and they went down at the beginning of the famine. So back and forth to Egypt, they're going to be going to Goshen, which is up in that Nile Delta in Egypt, the fertile plain, or the fertile delta of Egypt. I mean, this is the best land around of the world at that time. There was nothing better for raising grain because of the flooding of the Nile River into this delta and, you know, the river bottoms like we have here on the High River. All the river bottoms was always the best corn, right? And we repeat the story that we finished up in 46. So Joseph went in and told Pharaoh. Now remember, back in 46 when the brothers, and he introduced himself to the brothers, before he sent them back to get his dad, he told Pharaoh's servants to go tell Pharaoh that my dad and brothers are wanting to come down here and we need to set that up. So he didn't even walk directly into Pharaoh. He kind of set the stage, and now this time he's walking in directly to talk to Pharaoh, number two man in the nation, talking to the ruler of everything. My father, my brothers with their flocks and herds and all they possess have come down from the land of Canaan. They are now in the land of Goshen, and from there and from among his brothers he took five men and presented them to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said, what is your occupation? Just like Joseph had prepped him for. If you ever going through any legal process or whatever and worked with your lawyer before you go into trial, they want everything lined up, right? They're going to tell you, this is what they're going to say and this is what I want you to say. Back and forth, back and forth. And that's what Joseph did and prepped his brothers. Why did he only take five of them? Big discussion, yeah, right? And who did he take? You know, of all these other stories we've gotten, we've had every detail, we've had every person's person type thing. And now it says there's just five of them. So how does he pick the five? Did he pick the best looking ones? Did he pick the youngest ones? Did he take the scariest looking ones to prove to Pharaoh, you don't want these people around? You know? And there's been, you know, if you look through the commentaries and the comments throughout the internet and things, you know, there's about six different possibilities of what people think. You know, it really doesn't matter, but was it they took the scariest one to force Pharaoh to really push Pharaoh into saying, yeah, put those guys as far away from me as you can. Because if he took the fairest ones or the best, ones that make the best presentation, Pharaoh might want them for his household or keep them close by. And Joseph doesn't want that, remember? We're trying to keep his family away from the Egyptians so they don't get tempted with all the possessions of Egypt. So five standing before Pharaoh with Joseph, six of the 12. And they said to Pharaoh, your servants are shepherds as our fathers were. They said to Pharaoh, we have come to sojourn in the land, for there is no pasture for your servants' flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. And now, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen. Okay. So, famine affects the flocks too, remember. It's not just people. There's no grass. There's nothing for them to eat. They're going to lose the cattle if they can't, or the sheep or whatever else they have if they don't get them into a place that has grass. And it seems like Goshen still at least is survivable. Okay. But do you go up to your boss or do you go to ask somebody for a favor and ask for the best they have? You know. Because we find out later, Pharaoh's going to say, and Pharaoh said to Joseph, your father and your brothers have come to you in the land of Egypt as before you. Settle your father and your brothers in the best of the land. Let them settle in that land of Goshen. And if you know of any able men among them, put them in charge of my livestock. So it does work out. This is the way Joseph really wanted it. So his family is away from all the settlements, all the big cities of Egypt. Out in the plains, being an abomination to the rest of the Egyptians because they're handling all the animals. And Pharaoh's livestock, and now.
Yeah. I think they needed time to develop into a nation. Mm-hmm. So that a few generations later they could come up out of Egypt. But they also, I mean, his brothers had trouble compromising with the Canaanites.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure keeping them separate and away from the Egyptians might keep them more pure. For that time.
Right. Yeah.
And it wasn't just Joseph's idea. You know, this is being led by God. You know, Joseph didn't do anything without asking God for everything else he's had. He always gives God the, made sure everybody knew it was God that made the things happen in his life, not himself. So, yes.
I couldn't help but think there with the five brothers, mm-hmm. You know, we know that God had a hand in it, why those five, but it reminds you of 1 Samuel 15 and 16 there where Samuel goes to anoint the next king, and we know it ended up being David, but it starts out that he sees the first brother of Jesse and said, this is the one. And then God lets Samuel know, I look at things different than man does. You look at the outward, I look at the inward.
Yep. Also, just remembered that there's a kind of a story in Judges about the tribe of Dan. When they were going, they selected five men, but they chose the most presentable the most knowledgeable, the best they had to go. Because it says, you know, they didn't take them from the seashore. They took the five elites to go see the king. And that was kind of commented about, maybe they used the same thing they've heard about Joseph in presenting, you know, that's hundreds of years after the fact, but still, we are assuming since the story was continued through, it was handed down through the generations. But so anyway, God has Israel now saved from this famine, or did God create the famine to save Israel from itself? Did God make the famine come through as a way to get Israel out of Canaan, where they are already being corrupted? The first 12 that show up are already being corrupted by Canaan, don't have an army, aren't mighty. They are known, you know. Abraham had kind of an army that would go around, hit the small ones, but or defend themselves. They never really went out and conquered. They were defenders. But God used that to get Israel out of Canaan for a while in a protected area to grow into a nation. Because we'll see, he sent 70 family members of Israel down, and but they're estimating it was 2 to 2.5 million people left as Egypt to go back to Canaan. That's quite a growth in 400 years. And again, you know, this, that always kind of turns back around to us. When we find ourselves in a tough situation, when we think we are being knocked down, when we're at our lowest, and the comment always is, you say, why me? What did I do wrong? Or do you say, okay, what's God planning for me now? What's God getting me ready to do? You know, how's God using this to strengthen me, to prepare me for what's coming up? That's hard to do when you're flat on your back, or when people are after you, or you're hungry and poor and can't do anything yourself and you're relying on everybody else. What's God trying to teach me? What's God trying to get me ready for? Because that's, look at Joseph's life. We see that over and over and over again. He thinks he's a smart kid. He has all these great visions, and he gets sold into slavery. He gets sold into slavery, and he becomes, you know, head of a household. He runs the household. And he's up on top again, and then he gets the Potiphar's wife, you know, has him tried, basically, and Potiphar has him put in jail, slapped down again. And then he gets in charge of the jail and gets front Pharaoh, becomes second in command of Egypt. But could he have been second in command of Egypt without all those other training periods of, here's how it is to be nothing, and here's what it's like to have everything? What happens to most people when they come into a lot of money, or they get a lot of power immediately, or they're not prepared for it? It goes to their head and they lose all judgment. So the brothers are settled. He gets them in. They're going to be taken care of. So Joseph then brings in Jacob, his father, and stood him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Jacob, how many are the days of the years of your life? And Jacob said to Pharaoh, the days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days and the years of my life of my fathers and the days of their sojourning. 130 years old, just made a 200-mile hike. Remember, he was riding in the carts Pharaoh had sent up to make sure they could get everybody back home safely, or back down to Egypt safely. Still, would you like to ride in a cart today, any of you? I know they didn't have springs on them. I know they didn't have air conditioning. You know, 130 years old. And he comments that his life, they are few and evil. Did Jacob have that bad of a life? Well, he had to serve a father-in-law that kind of mistreated him. He had some other things happen to him, you know, that kind of twisted around. But who normally was cause of Jacob's problems? Jacob. Who's usually the biggest person that causes us our problems? Us, you know. Yeah, me, yeah. So, yep. How many generations has this been back we're reading about? Life hasn't changed. Mankind hasn't changed, you know. We are our own worst enemies some days. We get in our head, here's how it's going to be, right? And then we walk out the door and the world hits us flat in the face and we have no clue where we are anymore. Yeah. Our arrogance can get us in trouble.
Tom used to say, we have seen the enemy and it is us.
Yeah, there you go. Yep, we've seen the enemy and the enemy is us. So 130 years we've been studying these last 47 chapters really. 48 chapters, time we pick up when Jacob is born, remember? Jacob and Esau, that's how far back it's been. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from the presence of Pharaoh. So he blesses him twice. That's more of a, you know, it's good to meet you type thing at the beginning, and it's been great to meet you. I hope the world, you know, God blesses you and keeps you, and as you out the door type blessings. Then Joseph settled his father and his brothers and gave them possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. Who's Ramses? One of the pharaohs. May not have been this one, but still, it's noted that probably that Delta Egypt area that actually belonged to Pharaoh. That was Pharaoh's land. So he didn't take anybody out and move somebody else in. It was, Pharaoh already owns this part of Egypt. It's kind of a weird setup how they had it, but the priest owned sections, the Pharaoh owned a section, and all the rest of the people owned the rest of it. But he, the best of the land, Pharaoh has commanded, and Joseph provided his father and his brothers and all his father's households with food according to the number of their dependents. From speculation and studies of other people, it seems like that while they were living here during the rest of the famine, they don't have to pay for food. They're provided. Just like the priests were provided from Pharaoh's stores. So they're working for Pharaoh as his shepherds. They're keeping all that livestock for Pharaoh, so he's preparing for this. Yes?
The rest of the world is in famine, and so the numbers of the entire world would probably start to dwindle. Mm-hmm. But they're being provided for. Mm-hmm. God is providing through Pharaoh. For
right.
Them. And their numbers are going to increase so much that by the beginning of Exodus, it's a yeah. concern.
Right. Yeah. Got to find something for these people to do. All right. So God is providing here through Joseph. Now there was no food in the land, for all the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished by reason of the famine. We really don't have an understanding of what famine is like, do we? We've had some years of bad rain, you know, a little bit of drought when the gardens didn't grow. We look back at history. Some, I don't know if anybody here was living through the times in the Midwest, the Dust Bowl era, you know. That was as close as we've, as a country, have been in a famine. 2020 famine of toilet paper, right? that's about as worse as we think of. But, you know, that idea, when we look at that recent history of the 20s, you know, or 30s, when the Dust Bowl era, people were losing everything. You see the pictures of them shoveling out the front door of the little cabin to be able to get in because the sand had blown up against the house and they couldn't get into the house anymore. You know, those pictures are just unreal. And then people that moved there and went to California or to some place that still had things growing, you know, still had some rain, and the migration from the Midwest to the West Coast, you know, all the great stories that came out of that and all the literature that came out from that, you know. But this is what happened basically here. But it's languishing by reason of famine, and Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan in exchange for grain that they bought, and Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. Okay? Now, we got to look at where the time setting is, where the people are, the culture of the day, and not try to put it in today's context. Because there are so many comments on the internet, how bad this is, you know. Did Joseph have to require money? Why didn't he just give out the food? You know. So the people were paying for the grain. Now, that's how it was set up to begin with, remember? They brought all that money, so Pharaoh now controls the money, the physical money of all of Egypt and Canaan and all the rest of the area around there. And when the money was spent in the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us food. Why should we die before your eyes? For our money is gone." And Joseph answered, "Give your livestock, and I will give you food in exchange for your livestock if your money is gone." So, gave up their livestock. What were they feeding the livestock with? The grain they were getting, they were paying money for. So what was going to happen to the livestock if Joseph just gave them grain for themselves? He was going to die anyway. So here he's protecting the livestock for Egypt, taking it, and where do you think that livestock's going to go? Goshen. And who's going to take care of them? Joseph's family. So how do they prosper? Now they've got all the, you know, all the different animals from Egypt around, and to protect the animals during this famine. Okay, they put them in the area where they're most provided for.
I've heard that this is more of a serfdom kind of thing, where the people keep their livestock, but they don't own them anymore. They now are owned by Joseph or Egypt.
Right.
And so they're taking care of animals that they no longer own.
Right. But as we look at this, you know, like I say, you can't take it in today's context. This is not communism, where the government takes over everything and doesn't provide, or, you know, this is not what that is. Like I say, this was a preset concept that most of the people that were there that owned their own land, basically, were all ready conscripted to Pharaoh in the form of his military. That's where the army was, you know, from all the other people in Egypt. They all recognized Pharaoh as their intermediary for all their gods, whoever they worship. Pharaoh was the go-between. Now, why he had priests to help him with that, but their recognition of who Pharaoh was wasn't as concrete as it was later in the reigns of pharaohs. But here's kind of how it got consolidated. So they brought their livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them food in exchange for the horses, the flocks, the herds, and the donkeys. He supplied them with food in exchange for all their livestock for a year. So it wasn't a, you bring a cow and I give you a bag of grain. It was, here they said, here's all of our livestock. And he says, okay, you're good for a year. And when that year had ended, they came to him the following year and said to him, we will not hide from our my Lord that our money is all spent. The herds of our livestock are my Lord's. There is nothing left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our land. So who's forcing him to do this? The famine, you know. This wasn't Joseph's idea. This wasn't Pharaoh's idea. This is, they came to their own conclusion that I don't have anything left. I'm going to die. So you might as well take the land and I'll serve you if you'll feed me. That's exactly what they said. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for food, and we with our land will be servants to Pharaoh, and give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate. So Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, and all the Egyptians sold their fields because the famine was severe on them. They can't raise food on them. The land became Pharaoh's. As for the people, he made them servants of them. Note that is servants, not slaves. He made servants of them from one end of Egypt to the other. Only the land of the priests he did not buy, for the priests had a fixed allowance from Pharaoh and lived on the allowance that Pharaoh gave them. Therefore, they did not sell their land. They still couldn't do anything with it. It's in the middle of famine. They were being affected just as bad as everybody else. But so all that land now belongs to Pharaoh. But what did they ask for? Seed. Must be getting close to the end of the famine. Not just food. Now they're asking for seed to prepare the ground for planting again. Then Joseph said to the people, behold, I have this day bought you and your land for Pharaoh. Now here is a seed for you, and you shall sow the land, and the harvest you shall give a fifth to Pharaoh. Four fish shall be your own as a seed for the field and food for yourselves, for your households, and as food for your little ones. And they say, and they said, you have saved our lives. May it please my Lord, we will be servants to Pharaoh. So Joseph made it a statute concerning the land of Egypt, and it stands to this day that Pharaoh should have the fifth, and the land of the priests alone did not become Pharaoh's. So, one comment. Back where it says that, I can't figure out where it is here. Verse 21 says, as for the people, he made servants of them. Some of the translations have that as he moved them all to the cities. So he basically took them off of the lands, brought them into the cities. What's in the cities? All the food, because where did he store the grain for the good years? In the cities. So all the stores are in the cities. So to get rid, since they don't have cattle and they don't have all the transportation that they had, he moved them in closer to where the food was to help with the distribution of food. Because they don't need to be out on the land because they're not raising grain anymore. They don't have cattle to take care of. And he consolidated the population into the cities. But they, there's what I could read, and I'm no Egyptian scholar by any means. At that, you know, back when we were studying that in high school and junior high, that was the worst classes I could go to. but anyway, there is a study of a Egyptian history when it was retold that they were looking about 1,000 years after all this happened, of why does the people still pay Pharaoh a fifth or 20% of all their income? And the priests of that later time went back and found these stories and basically rewrote it. And it basically follows along the story of Jacob, but they didn't, or Joseph, but they don't call him Joseph. They don't call him the name Pharaoh gave him. It was a different name. And they almost made him a god in their retelling of this story 1,000 years after the fact. But they pointed back to, this is why we still pay 20% to Pharaoh. So when it says, you know, that Joseph made that statue that stands to this day, when was Genesis written? You know, by Moses. After they left 400 years or so later. So it was still the fact that in reality, like say a serfdom, when we look at the Middle Ages and different times of how different cultures progressed. You know, a king owned everything, but he allowed people to have the areas and they paid the taxes. Remember before the famine, during the 7 years of plenty, they were given 20%. So, and then Pharaoh was still buying more grain to put stuff away, and he was probably charging back the same price that they paid for it. At the end, Joseph gives them seed so they can go back and replant their crops. And if they're going to be planting crops, what do they need? Animals. So it looks like everything that Joseph took during the famine was basically given back to them after the famine so that they could continue on. So he kind of put them in storage for them, you don't think of it. He took care of the animals. He took care of the people. The land basically took care of itself. But when they moved back, they still continued on that tradition of 20% goes to Pharaoh and supports the nation. So, any comments, any questions?
I would think that the Pharaoh was more like a local ruler up until the time of Joseph.
Right.
And then after that, it became more of a national power.
Right. Yeah. He consolidated all that into the household of Pharaoh, whoever Pharaoh was of the day. Yeah. And again, this is God's plan. They wouldn't be doing it because remember, this is to protect Israel. So if Pharaoh's in control and Israel's working for Pharaoh and Pharaoh has everything now, who's going to complain about those shepherds down on the Delta taking care of everything? And the people were happy with it. Yeah, because it said, you know, they told Joseph, you've saved our lives. We tried. There's no way we could grow anything in this famine. There's no way a thing we have. It's, you know, I'm glad that you were wise enough to see the signs and know the dream and to put 7 years of good stuff away, because we wouldn't have put it away to last that long. You know, we've got times now, yeah, everybody's talking about, you know, being prepared to survive a catastrophe. You know, do you have enough food and water and stuff stored away at your house to last a couple days? How would you store up and prepare for 7 years? You know, it takes a large consolidated effort to do something like that. And Pharaoh had that. And Joseph built that and showed that, you know, made that happen. And then we go back to Israel. Thus Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they gained possessions in it, and they were fruitful and multiplied greatly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 147 years. So after the 5 years, or they were there to finish up the famine, he had, you know, 12 years of great living in Egypt. Do you wonder why nobody of the Israelites at that time said, okay, famine's over. They probably sensed and heard some things from Canaan that it was back in production again too. Why they didn't want to leave? You know, the brothers of Joseph, they're getting fed. They basically said, here's the best land in the world that you're raising your cattle and sheep on. You know, they are under protection of the greatest ruler of mankind of that day. They had everything they wanted. When you're fat, dumb, and happy, you sit still, right? Why would you want to travel 200 miles to go back to starting all over again? So 147 years old. Seems like an eternity nowadays. That's two lifetimes or three lifetimes almost. And when time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, if I have found favor in your sight, put your hand under my thigh and promise to deal kindly and truly with me. Do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. Carry me out of Egypt and bury me in my burying place. And he answered, I will do as you have said. Again, we see this taking an oath of putting your hand under my thigh. You know, that was more of a family, you know, where did we see this last, basically? Eliezer in Damascus. We see that in Abraham when he sends out his servant.
Same one,
yeah. But, you know, so that was with Abraham to promise to carry on the family tradition, go find my wife a son, or my son a wife. You know, go find my son a wife, promise me you'll do this. And there's been all kinds of conjectures of what all that entails and everything else, but it's basically, trust. I want you to trust me enough. You know, I'll set on your hand, basically, so you can't do anything. But you lower yourself down enough to say, I will do this, I guarantee. I'm not holding anything back. Right. Again, yeah. Yeah. All these years, Joseph has been the top dog. You know, in reality, anything he wants to do gets done. But to go to his father, and his father says, you guarantee you will take me back home and bury me in the family's plot, the family cemetery. How many of us have family like that, that, you know, no matter where they were when they passed away, they wanted to go back home and get buried up on top of the hill with everybody else? You know, we've got, that's kind of a human want and need, isn't it? To be buried with family, to be buried with loved ones. But he doesn't want to be left in Egypt because he was promised that he would be returned. God promised him that back in chapter 46, remember? You'll go to Israel, you'll go to Egypt, but you'll come back, but your son will close your eyes. So Joseph promised his dad, I'll take you and to bury you again in Canaan. And he said, swear to me, and he swore to him, and Israel bowed himself on the head of his bed. There's another word that this can be translated into besides bed is staff. We see back in Hebrews 11, it talks about by faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed both sons and worshiped, leaning upon the top of his staff in Hebrews. So the staff or bed, whichever it was, he bowed himself down. He worshiped at that time. So next chapter, 48, we'll find that things are finished finalizing up. We'll continue the story. We'll see what happens next. Any other comments, questions? Main thing to remember is God's in control. No matter how bad things seem, he's got a plan. We're part of his plan. So let's never forget that as we worship him. Thank you.
Almighty, Lord, saints and angels.